Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Hello, Mark.
Hey, Mona.
You know, there's lots of different podcasts out there, immigration-related podcasts, etc. We've heard this whole issue of a merits-based point system being brought in, but I don't think we've ever discussed it in the context of EB5 or in the context of something that I would like us to bring up today, a brand new white paper, a full discussion relating to point system and overhaul in the immigration program.
It's an interesting idea. It's not a new one, and I know the current president, Trump, has touted it as this great points-based system thing. And it certainly has its roots, I believe, going back before him. It's a somewhat interesting merits-based view on immigration. So I'm interested in exploring it today. And helping us exploring it is Mackenzie Eason. Mackenzie is a postdoctoral associate in Cornell's law school working with Professor Stephen Yale Lair. And it's there he focuses on migration and human rights programs, as well as the immigration law and policy programs that affect them. Prior to joining Cornell, Mackenzie Eason taught courses in international law, political theory, and international relations. Mackenzie Eason goes by the name Mac, for those that know him well, which also includes you, EB5 Investment Voice listener. Law professors, research fellows. Mona, how deep are we diving into this issue today?
Mark, anybody who has done EB5 has heard of Professor Steve Yale. He really wrote the book. Mac, thank you for coming on the show. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you on.
Mac, this is such a great area, and we're so excited to see where you're going to take us.
Mac, the first thing I'm going to ask you is why? Why did you do this study with Steve?
Well, in short, because Steve thought that it was time. Yeah, as you mentioned, I work with Steve Yale Lair, who is an expert in immigration law, and indeed, he wrote the book, a major treatise in the area. And he had a longstanding interest in immigration point systems. I co-authored a book with Dimitrios Papadimitriou on the subject in 96, a follow-up article a couple of years later, both of which argued that the U.S. should adopt this kind of system.
Let's pause for a second and explain. Yeah. I've spent some time reading this paper, and it's very detailed. But the very first thing is that it isn't a new area. It is there. It's prevalent in places like Canada, which I think we hear about it the most. Canada, New Zealand, Australia. What other countries, Mac?
So currently there are 11 countries or semi-autonomous territories that use a points-based selection system in one or more of their economic visa programs. Just a quick note up front, it's worth highlighting the difference between a points-based and a merits-based as terms.
Oh, yes. That's the question I was about to ask you.
Yeah. So these terms tend to get batted around and used interchangeably. So merit-based immigration or skills-based immigration, or even sometimes talent-based or knowledge-based, tend to be used interchangeably. And they generally refer to immigration systems in which candidates for immigration are selected, at least in part, by the state, by immigration officers, rather than by potential employers alone. And these candidates are selected on the basis of certain skills, talents, qualifications, training, or other human capital attributes. Points-based immigration systems it's kind of a subset of merit or skill-based immigration programs that assess individuals' applications for admission according to a quantified scoring system, so according to a set of points that measured factors like education level, employment experience, familiarity with the receiving country's language and or culture, and or arranged employment. So this scoring system consists of a list of attributes, so categories, a maximum number of points that can be granted for each of these factors, and guidelines on how the points for each factor will be assigned. If it helps, for those of us who've gone through, have been graded on the writing assignment, say, this points table is kind of similar to a grading rubric. used in schools.
Well, I do see the advantage, because here you're not looking at one adjudicator being biased and not really understanding the subject matter. You're going on a rubric, as you just stated, which is right or wrong or there or not. So I see the advantages of that. However, what exactly are you recommending in this program? Is this to replace the current existing system?
No, which is actually one of the novel elements of our proposal. So there have been a number of different attempts, as we've mentioned just a moment ago, to implement some sort of points-based or points-tested visa program in the U.S. What our proposal is calling for is a points-tested visa program. It establishes a 10-year pilot program allocating 50,000 permanent visas per year. Importantly, these 50,000 green cards would be in addition to the current yearly total. Our proposal doesn't make any changes to existing visa categories. Put another way, our proposal is meant to supplement existing visa programs, not to undermine or reduce them. So we are not making any changes to any of the other employment-based visa programs, but also, unlike some similar proposals that have been put forward by a number of people in the past, we are not calling for the reduction of the number of visas to be issued, say, through the family stream or through the humanitarian stream.
So this is in addition to?
This is in addition to. This would be, we are calling for the creation of 50,000 new green cards that would be for each year. They would be allocated according to our points-tested visa program. In that visa program, we are looking for, it's going to be a points rubric that is weighted towards longer-term human capital factors like educational attainment, age, experience, teamwork, and linguistic abilities.
So here I have an issue, and this is something that this is a problem I've had with all the point system in Canada and in other countries. And this is often something that we find which happens in EB-5. Somebody comes in with EB-5 and they really want to open up a business or give their expertise within an industry in this country. And they may be older, like 60s, 65, even beyond. But the wealth of experience that that person has and the ability to not just to understand and articulate and bring in because they've got a lifetime of experiences, that's all goes out of the window with a point system where when you're giving somebody maximum points for being, you know, in their 20s.
I would absolutely agree. That is an issue that comes up in point systems, any system that gives any sort of weight towards younger applicants. One of the features of ours, though, is that we have, say, just to lay out the kind of rubric here, we have 1,000 possible points, only 100 of which are allocated on the basis of age. For reference, we have 200 points that can be allocated on the basis of education, up to 200 points that are based on the an applicant's employment experience. So what is interesting about a point system, that the benefit of it is not only that it's quantified and transparent up front, but most immigration policy experts that have written on point systems argue that, say, a point system, quote unquote, in name only, such as that of the UK, that the UK currently uses, that effectively requires applicants to score highly on all of the categories, is in fact really not a point system at all. It's just a slightly quantified set of requirements.
So what you're proposing doesn't do that?
Our point system, as well as really any well-designed point system, is designed to allow for some slippage between candidates in terms of some of them will score higher. They will be, you know, in terms of age, they will be younger, but there are going to be a lot of candidates who are younger but have less in the way of education or employability or family support, which are all categories that we have. And so it allows for candidates to be ranked overall and to be able to make up for what would be perceived as lower scores in one category or another and still be eligible for admission or still be in the running, so to speak.
I see. Would you be adding a point system? Well, within your point system, would you be recommending points based on income? So you would have sort of high net worth investors being able to come in?
So we have not, but there are a number of different point systems around the world that have had that. And there is some disagreement over exactly how to measure that and whether it needs to be adjusted in terms of, you know, inflation or differences in average income in different categories or different professions across countries. But yes, that is a factor that could be included. One of the reasons why we didn't include it was that tends to be seen as a factor of employability. So that you, if you are highly paid in your industry from the country, in the country from which you're coming, then you would be likely to be either paid that or would be, you know, employable or competitive in the country, in the US. one of the things that we wanted to do with our point system, because it is designed to be additive, to sit beside the existing employment-based or economic-based immigration visas that exist in the U.S., is that we think that our program is addressing a policy gap in the existing programs in the U.S. Most all of the programs that exist in the U.S. right now are designed to address the short-term needs of the U.S. economy, either in terms of investment or in terms of employment.
Well, I think I already know the answer to this, but I'm going to ask it anyway. What's the problem with addressing the short-term needs of the United States?
The trouble with that model of selecting economic-based visa holders or foreign workers is that in many cases, the interests of U.S. employers may overlap with, but are certainly not the same as the interests of, say, the U.S. overall, the U.S. as a polity. And the longer term interests of the U.S., say, accumulating human capital, say, admitting people who will help, will be able to help the U.S. adjust to upcoming changes in, say, caused by technological changes or demographic changes, won't necessarily be the same individuals that would be selected by, say, hiring committees in the private sector. And so what our program is meant to do is to address that kind of longer term selection. So we really are, we deweight some of the employability factors, including not including deciding not to include, say, your former, an applicant's former salary, in favor of factors that are slightly less associated with short-term employability, but we believe will be important for kind of long-term economic, social integration, as well as helping the U.S.
Well, it's back to it's back to the brain drain. In the 90s, I know there was this huge brain drain, which at that time made sense because people were getting green cards very quickly. They weren't waiting for years and years like that is happening today. So these this is 50,000 visas that you're requesting, and you're requesting that in lieu of. But how would it impact the current programs for H-1Bs, EB-1s? EB-1 being for, highly placed individuals, and H-1Bs, of course, being the fastest way that a non-immigrant could get employment for a company.
The biggest impact that we hope to have is pressure relief. As you mentioned, the current U.S. immigration system is failing U.S. employers fundamentally in the country in a variety of ways. These failures are likely to become more serious in the near future. So as the U.S. economy and labor market change in the face of challenges like, say, the COVID-19 pandemic, automation, and aging workforce, there's ample evidence that even a moderate increase in skilled immigration would benefit the country. Existing skilled visa programs are backlogged and capped far below market demand.
Yeah.
One of the things that we hope our program would do is just to relieve some of this pressure on existing visa programs. But there's two other goals that we have for our program. One of them, again, is addressing this policy gap, so providing for longer-term economic and social needs of the U.S. But the third one is just to provide a proof of concept. So points, as you've mentioned, points-tested immigration programs have been extraordinarily successful in Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and elsewhere, and they've been proposed in the U.S. There's been a long-term question among immigration policymakers, though, as to whether a point system could work here in the U.S.
Mike, how long did you spend actually studying other countries?
This was a full year of research. We think that our report, one of the things that we've added to the literature, is really an up-to-date survey, not only of the countries that are often mentioned in this category, like Canada, Australia, New Zealand, but a number of other ones that it was kind of hard to dig up. So there are point systems, say, in Singapore, Hong Kong, a number of different ones in China, South Korea, etc.
So here's the thing, a country like Singapore or the UK, the size, the demographics, all of those things really make such a difference. I think perhaps the best comparison would be maybe Canada or Australia.
Indeed. Yes, we completely agree. And that's why in our report, we have a chapter introducing the idea and doing a widespread survey. But we also then have a chapter each having a case study digging into Australia and Canada, because they really are the countries that are closest to the U.S. in terms of their OECD status, in terms of their economies, in terms of their English common law background, etc.
So when you were trying to predict things such as what you call the economic social integration, they were closer?
They are closer to the U.S. Now, it should be said, those that have been skeptical of these kinds of programs have pointed out that although they are similar on all of those elements, the U.S. is, in terms of the immigration flows, is larger by an order of magnitude than either one of those states. And it also has a different governmental system. So it does not have a parliamentary system.
Well, Mac, let me to back up and just ask simply, what is the point of a points-based system? What is it essentially you're trying to predict?
Well, Mark, you know, before Mac answers that question, I want to just bring out a point. So lately, because of the current situation with the presidential campaign coming closer, we've been doing more than the average political Zoom calls. And we've been talking to both the Republicans and Democrats on people from different levels, you know, both congressmen and senators. And the interesting thing is, of course, we're always bringing up EB5. Both sides of the aisle are really in that vein of thought that they want to push what's called smart immigration forward, whether it's smart immigration for high-level employees, like something that I believe that Mac and Steve are aiming for, or whether it's for EB5. But it's not that it's just on the Republican side. I know the president has touted it, but it seems that the Democrats are behind it also.
Oh, certainly. And that's kind of the crux of my question is for the smart immigration, are the points to predict success and to make it smart and reduce the pressure, the immigration pressure on all the adjudicators? And I'm just wondering how that works.
In answer to your question, what we are looking for here, first and foremost, the reason why we are posing this as a proposal for 50,000 additional skilled visas is to increase the level of skilled immigration to the U.S. Again, it's a question of reducing some of the pressure on existing skilled visa programs. And one of the reasons why we have that goal is that there is ample evidence that skilled immigration is really, really good for the U.S. economy. It generates jobs, it increases wages. In a recent study, for every one additional temporary high-skilled worker hired by a U.S. firm, 5 to 7 new domestic jobs were created in that firm's industry. And per the New American Economy study of 219 U.S. cities, a 1% increase in skilled labor in STEM fields is associated with wage increases for both college-educated native-born workers, that's 7 to 8%, and non-college-educated workers up by 3 to 4%.
Okay.
Well, Mac, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
You know, we have the H-1B category. We have skilled workers. Have you thought, you and Steve thought about why not giving more visas maybe to the other immigration programs versus creating a whole new point-based system with the additional 50,000 visas?
Yes. So the logic here was basically that there have been efforts to increase the number of those visas for years. There have been at least 3 different attempts at comprehensive immigration reform since the year 2000. It looks to Steve and also to me that Congress is having some trouble going in and tinkering with that. So our proposal is to try and take a different stance. If we're having trouble agreeing on exactly how to adjust existing visa categories between, say, both sides of the aisle, that's fine. That is absolutely something that should be addressed. And it's something that should be addressed in large scale immigration reform, not only for the economic visa programs, but other visa programs too. You know, frankly, we both argue that the U.S. should be admitting more immigrants in most categories more generally. Our proposal is meant to be a first step. The strategy of pursuing comprehensive immigration reform has stumbled a few times in the last couple of decades. And ours is one voice among a number of different voices that have said, let's try for piecemeal approaches. Our proposal certainly isn't going to solve all the problems, but it's kind of worth a shot. Let's see if we can relieve some pressure on the existing EB visa programs by having another route in and maybe be able to kind of address some of the problems with the EB programs once some of the pressure is taken off.
Well, I have to say, though, that it's about time, and I think that this is very necessary. Rebecca and I have seen lately that there's a host of people who really cannot afford to come in through EB5 anymore since the amount has been raised, and certainly not put that kind of money aside for 5 to 7 years, which is what is expected for EB5. So there are people who have, as I've mentioned before, older parents who would bring in so much to this country. Perhaps this is just the right way, Rebecca.
Yeah, I was just telling you, with the EB5 program, when we were at 500,000, we saw so many skilled or high-level individuals who were coming in. You know, we saw doctors, we saw tech, we saw pharmacists coming in. And going up, like you said, to 900,000 really kind of limits those individuals from coming in. So I think this would be a great start. But Mac, I have a question, another question for you. Mm-hmm. Would there be a limit on the country cap?
Yeah, good point.
No. Thank you for asking that question. No, our program we propose would not be subject to existing country caps, which is one of the reasons we believe that it would be able to relieve some of the existing pressure on the EB programs, because there are backlogs of years to decades, depending on where you're coming from. And ours would not be subject to country caps.
Mac, I noticed that in your white paper, you state this as a permanent visa rather than go through the hoops of being a temporary visa and then filing for permanent visa. That's going to be a huge advantage for a lot of people. But why did you do it that way?
We did it that way for a number of reasons. I mean, one could argue for it in terms of the U.S.'s competitiveness on the global stage. We are active. We as in the U.S. are actively losing potential skilled foreign workers to, say, Canada and Australia, because those two countries do offer direct access to permanent employment visas. And that is a bargaining point. On the other side of it, we think that deciding to offer direct access to permanent employment visas to the skilled foreign workers that we're looking for would be beneficial to the U.S. society, but also beneficial to the workers themselves. It allows them to bypass the hurdles that are and the psychological and financial costs of having to transition from a temporary visa to a permanent visa. They are able to direct the psychological energy, that economic capital, towards contributing to their communities here in the U.S.
And this would, of course, include their spouse and dependents?
This would include their spouse and dependents. In fact, so the 50,000 that we have proposed would be 50,000 primary foreign workers. The number of spouses and dependents would not be included in that 50,000. They would be over and above that, obviously, in terms of the net gain.
I like that idea. We should do that with EB-5.
Yes.
I wish we had that.
In fact, we actually have a points bonus for those that are concerned that this is a purely kind of economistic approach. We allocated points to be granted to applicants who either have a first degree relative that is living here in the U.S., so a brother, sister, spouse, parents that is already living here in the U.S. as a resident, and points for those applicants who would be bringing with them a spouse, brother, parent, dependent, because there is significant social, scientific, and economic data suggesting that having family support while you are integrating into a new society tends to be associated with stronger both short-term and long-term outcomes.
Perhaps. I do remember when I entered the United States some years ago, I didn't have any support here or any friends or any relatives. So not always.
Well, there are the outliers, Mona.
Yes, certainly. People coming into the U.S. can have great outcomes, regardless of whether they have direct family support here. In terms of the overall aggregate associations that we see in kind of statistical outcomes, those that do have family support tend to have better outcomes. And it's not a question of whether one can or cannot. It's just a question of encouraging or incentivizing or helping those people that come in, giving them points for bringing their family with them.
Well, Mona, I'm going to ask you a question. If this comes in, how do you think it's going to affect, let's say, the EB-5 program? Do you think more people will end up trying to go on this points-based system versus having to spend $900,000?
I can certainly see many of our clients who are doctors and high net worth professionals coming this route rather than EB-5. So I'm going to ask you, Mac, how about doing a program or a white paper like this for EB-5?
I think that would be a great idea. And there's a very good chance that I or Steve or someone else associated with the Cornell Immigration Program, Cornell Law School's Immigration Law and Policy Program, will likely undertake a research into something like expanding the EB-5 program or building a proposal for a new investor program.
In your paper, you advocate for a standalone bill. Do you have any champions right now?
Well, we've presented this to a number of different congressional staffers, and we've been getting really good feedback on it. We genuinely think that this is a proposal that could be supported, that could garner support on either side of the aisle, on both sides of the aisle. It has elements embraced both by the right and the left, and we think it would be a small enough, low enough cost, both politically and economically, to be passed, either on its own as a standalone bill or as part of the general economic recovery.
I like that, Mac. And in the spirit of work on Capitol Hill, I would like to tack on to that if I can. And maybe if we could also get the same amount of support for EB-5. You mentioned before 5 to 7 jobs for each one of these points-based visas offered.
Good point.
I know the visa program that offers at least 10 jobs, because if not, the person's out. So yeah, maybe we could do EB-5 as well.
That sounds great.
Well, Mackenzie Eason, this has been a very eye-opening episode for me and learning a little bit more about this proposal for a points-based immigration system. That's a lot of P's. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being with us today on EB-5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw and Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB-5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB-5 Investment Voice.